Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last summer, the world learned about a new mosquito-borne virus called Zika. Some victims show no symptoms. Others get a little flu-like illness. But the offspring of pregnant women who get the disease are at risk for serious health and developmental problems. Zika is just another reason why public health officials are concerned with controlling mosquito populations in places like Columbus. Joining us now to talk about mosquitoes and more is entomologist and founder of Bugman Education, Mark Berman. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
You don't really...
Am I on here?
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh.
There we go. There's Mark Berman. Mark Berman, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Wait, is this thing on?
Let's do that all over again. You don't really like talking about this whole mosquito. You're not a mosquito-borne disease expert, but you know a lot about mosquitoes.
I studied mosquitoes when I was in grad school, and there's lots of other things I'd rather talk about with bugs. Or even with mosquitoes, because they're just cool. And the things that they do are cool. And if you, it's almost like with spiders, if you get past the whole biting part, they're just really cool. And mosquitoes are the same way. But I spent a lot of time doing, working with some bug people, some bug killing people in Massachusetts and writing some of the integrated pest management protocols for the state of Massachusetts. And when you go to college to learn about insects, you basically learn about control. That's most, especially a land grant college that's agriculturally based. Most of the programs are focused on pest control in homes or in, you know, agricultural fields. And so you learn a lot about, you learn a lot how to kill bugs when you want to go study how cool bugs are.
I remember it might have been the last time you were on or the time before, and we started getting lots of calls for people how to get rid of this bug and how to get rid of that bug. And we had to remind people that you're not really in the business of getting rid of bugs.
I don't mind
That's
helping.
Not your stock and trade. Controlling pests is one thing. I learned this weekend when I was at the farmer's market, this lady was selling all different kinds of cranesbill or native geranium species. And some of them are good at controlling mosquitoes.
I've
heard
it's
a smell.
Yeah, I've heard that there are plants you can use to control rabbits and stuff too, but I've never heard about that with mosquitoes. Maybe.
Yeah, I hadn't either. And
they might.
I'm all in though, because I don't want to be spraying chemicals into the air.
Right. The best way to get rid of mosquitoes though is dump out water anywhere you find water.
Standing water.
Yeah. A friend of mine on Facebook sent a photo of posted a photo of her. I don't know if it was her niece or her granddaughter, but a cute little two-year-old girl, and she was sitting on this big tire that was painted, that they had decorated the garden with used tires and painted the garden. And it looked kind of cool, and they were nice little seats that you could have or run around in and play with. And you could see right along the edge the little puddle of water that was in the tire, and she was just sitting on it like a mosquito nursery. And so I said, you got to drill some holes in that tire.
Yeah.
So if you have a tire swing or anything out in the yard that can collect small pools of water, it only takes like a week or so for a mosquito to go through.
Even bird baths, you want to be refreshing them almost every day.
Or put a bubbler in it if you can. And that keeps the water fresh anyway from, you know, from bacteria growing. But the best thing you can do is just go on a scavenger hunt. And just, you'd be surprised if you look around where you'll see even like you know, like a carton or like any kind of box top or anything, anything that can hold a puddle for, you wouldn't think wood could, but anything that can hold a puddle for a couple of weeks is going to be a big mosquito problem.
A mosquito, typically, how many little eggs does it lay in any given minute?
An adult female can lay 100 or more, sometimes 300 or 400.
In its life?
Usually it'll lay like a small cohort of them. The ones that we studied usually laid about 40 or so at a time. And they'll, there's different species that breed in water. The ones that spread Zika are very common in tires. They evolve to breed in tree holes. So when there's damage in a tree and it collects water, and that's really nutritious habitat. Lots of stuff grows in there.
Okay.
And so, but tires are an easy analog for it. And then I knew a guy in Florida who studied the biology that lived in cemetery urns. That was his whole career, was he went around cemeteries and dipped in the water to see what was living in the cemetery urns that collected water. And so they'll go any place that there's water. The ones that we studied laid their eggs right at the surface of the water. They had to dry out and then get resubmerged. And so they could stay dry for a really long time. So even ones that were laid last fall, once the springs come and the water starts getting in there, they can hatch really quick, turn into mosquitoes really quickly.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Mark Berman, founder of Bugman Education, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can check out Facebook and post a question or comment there. We're also on Facebook Live today. So if you want to watch us on Facebook Live, please do. Mark's trying to get out of the way of the camera, but they're everywhere.
Mark. I was trying to clear my throat.
Okay. And we have some things to look at. That's why we decided to do Facebook Live today with this, because Mark always brings in lots of interesting things, including something you can find out and about right now, which are, you call them housings, or what do you call them?
The official name is Ootheca, O-O-T-H-E-C-A, Ootheca.
Uh-huh.
And whenever you see a word that's got O-O at the beginning of it, it means egg. And so,
okay.
So Ootheca is an egg case. And so these are egg cases that a praying mantis makes. You can check that out.
Yeah.
And the one that you're holding right now, they look sort of like dried out marshmallows. And if you feel them,
like little miniature wasp nests.
A little bit, yeah. Except for if you feel them, they're not really made out of the kind of paper. There's nothing in there.
I can touch it?
Yeah, there's nothing in there. They're already hatched.
Oh.
But doesn't it almost feel like a dried out marshmallow?
How did they touch? Where did they hatch from?
Yeah, they just come out of little holes in the, if you look at the top one where all those little ridges are, they come out through there. But they are really small when they squeeze out.
Yeah, they are.
And they hang down on mucus threads and shed their skin on their way out and then just run off. And, you know, like an hour later, they can catch flies. They don't usually start eating until the next day or two, but they can catch flies. Right. Well, their parents are dead. And so their parental care amounts to that right there. The mom makes this. And it's interesting when she makes it because it comes out of the end of her abdomen, as you might expect.
But, same old thing.
But it doesn't come out like in one big plop. It comes out like froth. And so she'll go up to a stick and kind of bubble some on and then put some eggs in it and then bubble some more on. And it takes her about an hour or so to make one of those. And then what happens is that the bubbles, when it dries, the bubbles become air pockets. And air is a great insulator. And so in the wintertime, when those are up in trees or up in bushes, exposed to the element, although we didn't really have any elements this winter, but in the wintertime, the pockets of air help insulate that. But that's the end of their parental care.
These two egg casings are on kind of a, not a really a tree-like thing. It's more like a
some
bush
kind of a,
usually, stalk. It looks like it actually broke this little branch on here.
I probably
you
did.
You did that.
It didn't,
oh,
yeah.
Okay, sorry. I just thought I was discovering something.
I probably
new.
Did that actually before she made that one. Excuse me. Those were made in captivity, and so I don't even know what that stick is from.
These
it was just
are non-native, but they're very familiar.
Those are the Chinese mantids, which are the real big ones that you see around here with a green band on their wings. And they are non-native, but they're considered naturalized. They've been here for a couple hundred years. Some people think it's okay. Some people think it isn't. The bottom line I heard one time was that they have an ecological role in the environment, sort of not like the stink bugs that have been recently introduced to get in people's houses and stuff. But these guys are sort of more settled in. Although, if they're in your garden, they'll eat anything they find, and they're big. Some of them will eat hummingbirds, even. They've been seen eating. Yeah, you can find.
I am just like not.
You can find footage of them eating.
I'm bored with this at all. I mean, I did not know they could eat hummingbirds.
Did you say you're not on board with?
Yeah, they don't look that big.
Something's got to eat hummingbirds. Something's got to eat everything, or we'd be up to our ears.
Yeah, but there's lots of aphids out there.
This is one of the babies that comes from there.
You mean that's
and
that's
it's okay if it's
but
on
this
your hand.
Is not how big it is. Oh, my
it's
God.
Okay if it's on your hand. It won't hurt you. Don't worry. Ah, it's okay if it jumps too. And they like to go up.
Oh,
so,
gosh, look at him.
Yeah, this one is about a sixth grader if it was a person.
Okay.
And so it's got a bit to grow, probably two or three more skin sheds. I don't know if it's moving too fast for the camera, but if you were outside now, you would find some probably that are a little bit smaller than this. This is a little bit early. It's about a month and a half or 2 months old. We raise them all year long because our mascot, PR Mantis, wants us to always have live mantids in our programs. And so we almost always have babies, but that one's a little bit old for nature right now. You see, it'll go up on your hand.
Oh,
they
yeah.
always go up. And since they always go up, if you hold your finger above them, you can pretend, here, I'll take it.
And they think they don't realize it, but they're going up, but they're not.
Right,
really.
And if you hold right above it, you can pretend like it's showing you its legs like a dog would. They always want to climb what's above them. And so, I mean, an animal that lives in bushes or in trees doesn't want to be on the ground. I mean, if you're not adapted.
Do you want the smirk, Beck?
Oh, I don't know. Okay. I thought you were trying to get rid
of
it.
No.
Okay. Oh, okay. But so they'll always, so you can go like, here, show us your legs. Here, show us, no, show us.
Okay.
Oh, wait, no,
right,
you climbed. No. But you can go, here, show us your legs. Show us your legs.
He's like, okay, and, all right. If I could only speak English.
Yes.
Okay,
well, look,
I would
he's
say
doing
yes.
It.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, and then, and if you put it on the ground in front of somebody, it'll climb up their shoe, up their leg, and all the way up to the top of their head. It always goes
when
up.
Does it turn green?
Sometimes they don't turn green, and sometimes on the last skin shed or two, they'll turn green. But this species always has a bright green band on the side of its wing.
Okay.
So whether it's green or brown as an adult, and sometimes they're green as babies too. And I think it's environmental. I'm not sure.
In your logo, I think you have a praying mantis, right? Is this like a favorite type of thing for you? Is
PR mantis?
Yeah.
Well, we needed a logo. I drew PR mantis when I was in high school. And so okay, he just kind of became our mascot.
Okay.
And so, and he's cute. And so everybody always tells me to change him.
He dies every year and you can get a new one. This is, now this would really fool me. These are very hard to see, these egg casings.
And there's a number of them on there. There's maybe five or six
on there.
And
they hatched as well?
Those have hatched as well. And I mean, you can see the ridges in them. And I mean, basically each of those is an egg. And by the way, in here about 50 or so.
They look like. Well, you can imagine.
You said when you hatch one of these, a whole bunch of them came. So you know 50 or 60 or so will come out of here. And, you know, maybe 20 or so will come out of each of those. And this one is from, and I don't have one, but that is from a Carolina mantis. And they're smaller, like capsules instead of big marshmallow shapes. And they have ridges on them. And it's a smaller mantis. And the adults get a little bit bigger than this baby here, but they get about a couple inches, but not like the big, huge praying mantises. And they're kind of a mottled brown or green color. They're real beautiful, and they're really animated. And they're one of my favorite mantises. I don't have any this winter, though. But so if you see those, a lot of times you'll see them on wood fences or on... Okay.
There's a weird piece of hair in there.
It's probably from a cocoon or something. I have cocoons over every once in a while.
Yeah.
But... you'll see those a lot of times on like wood fencing or on a deck or something. And so if you see kind of a flat capsule-like brown, and it's hard to describe as anything but an egg case. I don't know how you would describe it, but it looks like a little capsule.
It looks almost like, oh, darn it.
Yeah, I said it's hard to describe.
Words escape me, but like a fossil.
A little bit, yeah.
Like you could imagine these things being fossilized. That's sort of, they're fossily looking. They're old looking. And I'm sure they're very old.
These guys aren't. These guys are, they're a little bit lighter when they're fresh, but I've had these for a little while.
Okay.
And these are very hard to get off.
But so I mean like the species, yes.
Oh, and the species is, and it's a Carolina mantis.
Yeah.
It's native, even though it's called Carolina, but it's from around this part of the country. And so, I imagine it's a very, very old species, too.
We're talking about bugs with Mark Berman, founder of Bugman Education. He's an entomologist and a teacher, and he's been on many, many times before, but it's been a while. So we're talking about what to look forward to this summer when it comes to bugs.
Speaking of having been on before, this is an old friend of yours. The last
time. Is this the jumping spider?
No.
Okay.
Although I have it if you want to see a jumping spider.
Buzz Lightyear
spider.
I told
you we're not going to do anything scary today. Yeah. But last time I was
this
on.
This is an old friend of mine. Oh.
I had a baby. I had baby.
Strange.
Leaf-headed mantises.
Yes.
And this is a grown-up.
They are so. I mean, I don't. Oh, you're like. Oh,
it won't hurt
you
either if it climbs
on
you.
I mean. I don't know if they can capture this on Facebook Live or not. You can get it. Check out Facebook Live because
it's looking towards
there's
me.
There's
right
just
now.
The coolest. Well, there's your daddy. I mean, of course, he's like, "What am I supposed to do with her?" It's really hard to see, but if you can, it's so interesting. It's like Groot, but it's a praying mantis. So
I'm going to take your word for that Groot thing. I don't even
Groot,
know.
Guardians of the Galaxy. Groot's my favorite character.
Okay, I didn't see.
Okay,
that.
So this dude is
just like
seriously
Groot.
Cute and now that's, leafy.
She's one of the ones that I had last time I was here,
oh.
And they were little babies, and they curled their abdomen up, but they
uh-huh.
still had that leaf on their head, and they all grew up. And there's two of them left. I had, I think, five to begin with, and there's two of them left. And there's some photos on our Facebook page of what they look like then and now and when they were growing up.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, do they like to be petted?
They don't.
Can I touch her?
She won't mind if you touch her, but she might kind of crouch down. I don't know. Yeah.
I have no feeling in that finger. I don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's something. Now she's giving me the eye.
Well, usually touching a bug is a precursor to eating a bug. And
gotcha.
So,
no, so. Not interested.
But that is Phylocrania paradoxa. A paradox is like something puzzling, right? And you look at it and you think, is that a bug or a leaf? But then phylocrania is, your cranium, like the IUM words, like gymnasium, auditorium,
yeah.
Big places where cool stuff goes on. Your cranium is the big place where your brain fits. And so it's an IUM because it's sort of like a big open space for your, like a big room for your brain. And phylo is like phyllo dough. It's leaves. And so phylocrania means leaf-headed. The leaf-headed paradoxical mantis. Some people call them ghost mantises.
They look alien.
Yeah.
So interesting. Hey there.
So I thought she'd want to come visit you again.
Is she of the age to create her own little... Oh, she already did?
These are her egg cases.
But she didn't die.
I'll trade you.
Okay. I've got the egg cases. Very interesting. They look like...
Similar to the Carolinas, but...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Folded leaves, like curled leaves.
And they always leave like a little tail on the end of it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so she never got mated. And so her eggs probably won't hatch.
Oh.
They lay their eggs when you don't have a really long life cycle, you can't always wait for the right guy to come around. And so they just start making eggs.
Yeah.
Right when they're adults. And then once they mate, they fertilize the eggs on the way out. They store the reproductive stuff from the male, fertilize the eggs on the way out. So they can be laying eggs, but then once they mate, the ones after that will be fertilized.
Okay.
And it sets up an opportunity for, a lot of, I don't know if any mantises are, but there are a lot of insects that are parthenogenic, where like aphids, where there are no boys.
Okay.
And that's called parthenogenesis. And aphids will have boys at the end of the season or during hard times. They'll make boys. That happens all the time. I know.
Something floating in my water.
I know. My old girlfriend used to complain about fruit flies in the coffee all the time. Sorry. now you made me forget what I was talking about. I'm going to have some water.
Parthenogenic. Don't need the guys. Okay.
So a lot of times, weed species want to move into a new habitat as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm.
Aphids are a classic weed species. And so they're almost all females. They don't lay eggs. They have live birth. The babies, when they're born, will sometimes have babies already developing inside of them. So they'll give birth to their daughters and granddaughters at the same time. And then when times are tough, they'll make males, get wings, and then they can disperse to a new area and start a new colony. But then they go right back into parthenogenesis. And there's a lot of walking sticks that don't have males. And I don't know if there's any mantises, but, a lot of insects will just lay eggs. And then, and then when they mate, the eggs will be fertile. But a lot of them, they'll mate infertile eggs.
We have to take a break.
Okay.
We're way overdue for this right now. We will be right back with Mark Berman, founder of Bugman Education, entomologist, and God knows what he has with him left. He's got a big box, and he's not showing me everything all at once. So stay with us. Check us out on Facebook Live, too, to see all the things that Mark brought today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the world of insects with entomologist and founder of Bugman Education, Mark Berman. If you have a question or comment for Mark, give us a call, 614-292-8513. or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page because we're on Facebook Live right now, and Mark has lots of cool things to show us, and it's a really easy way to check that out. Or you can go to WOSU.org and just follow us online as well. You don't like to talk about bugs and disease.
By the way, we didn't finish with Zika. And so just real quickly, okay. There were about 14 incidents last summer in Ohio. Although the range of the mosquito—
Of Zika being discovered in a mosquito.
In people, I believe.
In people, okay. Mm-hmm.
Although the range of the Aedes aegypti mosquito that spread Zika only sort of stops around central Ohio. So it's mostly southern Ohio now.
Yeah.
That's probably going to change pretty quickly just because it's warmer up here than it used to be. And
right.
So they'll probably keep moving north, but an individual mosquito doesn't go that far. So at this point, really the only place that Zika in Ohio is an issue at all is in southern Ohio. And I know I made the point last time that you'll hear a lot of news about it, especially at the beginning of the summer, but it's really kind of a small deal unless you're thinking of having children or unless you're
right.
pregnant. And so in the United States right now, Brownsville, Texas, and places around Miami Beach, Miami-Dade County and Miami Beach are yellow zones where you're supposed to think twice before you travel there if you're thinking about having a family.
Yeah.
And otherwise, that's the only place in the United States right now where it's really considered a problem, major problem by the CDC.
Ticks are another issue. Lyme disease has been a concern with ticks for a long time. Now there's a new virus that health officials are concerned about. We had an email from Cynthia asking us about it. It's called the Powassan virus. And I know it's coming in from the East Coast. It's kind of shocking how fast it spread out there, but it's also coming at from Wisconsin as well.
Right. It's northeastern, and they say the Great Lakes regions, but it hasn't been seen in Ohio so far. And it's kind of shocking how fast it's coming, except for there's about 7.5 cases a year so far.
Right.
So 7.5 cases a year isn't that many.
But the spread of the tick that...
And that's over the last 10 years. But the tick that spreads it is the same one that spreads Lyme disease,
yeah.
a regular deer tick. And... so they've been around for a long time, but ticks are much worse now than they've been for a real long time. And the warm winter that we had helps tick populations. And also apparently white-footed mice.
The people who are studying those, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they are supposed to be a huge vector for a huge host for the ticks also, which will increase the tick population, which increases the likelihood that we'll run into them. And also big deer populations, which we've never had deer populations like we do now.
Right.
And so, you know, you go out now and ticks are really annoying. But when I was a kid, I don't think I'd ever do this if ticks then were like they are now, because I used to be up to my ears in fields every day, all day. I never saw a tick.
Yeah.
And now you go out and they're everywhere. And so there's not a whole lot you can do about it except check yourself when you get back in, tuck your pants into your socks, and, mm-hmm. you know, if you wear a snowsuit, you're safe in the middle of summer. But if you cover yourself up as much as possible, and then you can use DEET-containing insect repellents.
With DEET.
With
okay,
DEET,
yeah.
But I wouldn't use a whole lot of it. I've actually had an allergic reaction to DEET before that was almost as bad as the mosquitoes in Florida that I was trying to combat. And so, you know, you want to be real careful with pesticides, and especially if you're going out, or repellents also. Especially if you're going out in nature, then you don't want to like be spraying off all over the place. And you mm-hmm. don't want to be spraying DEET all over the place. And so it's usually best if you're going to go on a hike or something, to put it on in the parking lot before you go out into the field. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be handling stuff, you don't want to have it all over your hands because obvious, and you don't think about it. But if you rub it on your skin, you got it on your hands too. And then if you go out and try to handle a caterpillar or something, you're getting it all over the caterpillar.
And you're going
to
kill.
So if you're going to enter, or even leaves, if you're going to interact with nature, then you want to wash your hands of any insect repellents before you go out. And it's better to use lotions than sprays, because sprays are spraying all over the place, and so lotions are usually better. And so check yourself when you get back in.
Tick check.
Yeah,
tick check.
If you're on a date, it can be fun.
That's gross. Okay, Patrick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Patrick.
Yes, good morning. I was calling about the stink bugs that seem to be everywhere in Columbus these mm-hmm. days. And it seems to me that they have an interesting life cycle in that they can come into the home in the fall and live there through the winter and then get up and get going again. I've even seen them on a screen on the outside of the house through the freezing winter, and then they're alive again. So they seem to be freeze-thaw stable. And I'll just listen to what you have to say.
Well,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Patrick. They're like little armored cars.
Yeah, and they're actually in the house to overwinter. They overwinter as adults, and they're native. They're a recently introduced species. Introduced species have a tendency to cause a lot of trouble right away and then sort of settle into the habitat. And I mean, ladybugs
did this.
Hopefully
they find a predator to...
Right.
Who enjoys their crunchy.
Or just the boon of their initial numbers.
Okay.
You know, if it's another weed type species that has a lot of babies and tries to just sort of take over by numbers, then eventually their advantage dies out and nature catches up with them. Ladybugs were 15 or 20 years ago. They were doing the same thing that stink bugs are now, too, mm-hmm. where houses would get clobbered with thousands of Asian ladybugs. And now it doesn't happen quite as much. They've kind of settled in more. But in both cases, they overwinter as adults. And in their native range, they'll go usually upland and find usually a white surface like a big rock or a piece of wood to go underneath, and they'll shelter under there. So they usually don't really freeze, and especially with a winter like we had this winter, they don't. It's not that hard for them to survive. But when they come here, they get in houses, and you see them in the fall coming in, and they'll get into the wall voids and the attic and any place that they can find a little bit of warm shelter. And so in the house, they're actually not freezing sort of any more than you are. Even if they're up in the attic, they're finding warm enough places to stay. And then you see them in the spring coming back out again.
If I see two or three a night in my house, about how many are probably in there?
50, 60,000. I don't know.
Are you kidding me?
Yes, I'm kidding you. I'm sorry. I tried to say it with a straight face.
What are we talking here?
Well, the ones you see are usually the only ones to concern yourself with. I mean, if you see a whole bunch of them, then you have a whole bunch of them. But if you only see a few stragglers, mm-hmm. then there's probably not a whole lot more. And a lot of the ones that come in, not necessarily a lot, but some of the ones that come in are going to die wherever they've. But you'll never see them again. I mean, they'll just be in the wall void forever. Mm-hmm. And they don't, ironically, they don't smell when they die like you might expect. They smell when they're getting killed. But
yeah, I don't kill them. I let them outside.
I don't blame you. Oh, I made a video of a black widow eating one last summer, and it smelled so. At first, it isn't a horrible smell, but boy, it gets really, really intense. And so I kind of had to set the camera up and go out of the room for a few minutes.
What makes them stink?
They have it's a defense mechanism, and they have glands that just make a stinky chemical, and I mean that's their defense. A lot of bugs do that, and I mean I don't know if you ever heard of like a bombardier beetle that shoots. It has they're little. When you see pictures of them, they look huge, but they're beautiful little red and blue beetles. And if you the classic stress that they put them under is they'll grab one of their legs with forceps. And then they have in their abdomen, they have two chambers where they keep two different chemicals. And when they're alarmed, they mix them in a third chamber. And it's an exothermic or energy liberating reaction. And it liberates the energy in the form of boiling acid that shoots out of their abdomen with an audible pop. And they spray it. And they can spray it in any direction that, like, if you grab them on any leg, they can angle it and spray it in that direction. And you, like, it's really little, so it doesn't, like, burn you or anything, but you can feel it's real warm. And if they do hit something sort of their size, it's like this burning acid that they shoot at them.
Wow.
I know. They keep it separate inside of them so that they don't burn themselves up, but then they do this reaction and expel it real quickly. They're called bombardier beetles.
Good glory. We have a caller, Mark, who wants to Mark Berman, to clarify about types of ticks. You made reference to the deer ticks, which are carrying the pole.
And there's also dog ticks, which are.
Yeah.
And I'm only marginally clear. And so I think you can only sort of hold me to this. I mean, Google it if it's going to be a real thing. But deer ticks are a little bit smaller than dog ticks.
Yep.
Dog ticks, I don't believe, spread any diseases to humans. And they're the bigger ones that you see sort of – that you used to see more frequently. Although now deer ticks – and I think they're also called wood ticks.
Okay.
And so I think they have two common names. And that's where it gets a little bit confusing. But they're a little bit smaller and and especially the young ones are kind of hard to find, so you have to look real closely. And so now both of them are very common here. And so
they can look like a tiny little freckle.
Yeah, they can.
Once they've embedded.
And then sometimes they're a little bit bigger, too. The deer ticks get a little bit bigger than a freckle, but more like a mole maybe. But if you have a tick on you, it kind of, I mean, get it off and it kind of doesn't matter, and then just monitor for disease. You know, if you get a deer tick on you or in you, it doesn't automatically mean you're going to get
right.
Lyme disease anyway. The Powhasan, whatever they call it.
Yeah. Powhasan.
Powhasan. One of the big differences with that one is for the tick to transmit it, takes like 15 minutes. For Lyme disease, it takes 36 to 48 hours of continuous feeding on you.
Uh-huh.
And so that's another thing that makes the researchers a little bit more concerned that might become a big, a big epidemic. But so far, there's no evidence that it will. It's just got the potential to. So, I mean, to answer the caller's question, I think if you have a tick on you, it's a tick and it kind of almost doesn't matter what species it is, because then you start, you know, if it's feeding on you, then if it's just real quick, then you don't have to really worry about it. And if it's been for a day, then you start looking for symptoms of it. Most people end up with very, very minor symptoms for that bacterial infection. And I mean, if you identify the tick or not, it kind of doesn't matter. But if you get a tick on you, the best thing to do is right when you know it's on you is to take your thumb and forefinger as close to your skin as possible and just twist and pull. When a tick bites you, it puts its stylets into your skin, and then it's got this thing called a labial palp that opens up, and it's like this big big shroud that goes over
uh-huh.
it, and they fill that with glue.
Uh-huh.
And they glue themselves on. So you try to take them off and their heads will pop off usually before you can break that. But if you take them and you twist them when you pull them off,
uh-huh.
you'll hear a little pop, and that's when that whole shroud comes off. And then when they're done feeding, they secrete an enzyme underneath that and dissolve the glue so they can get themselves off again. It's kind of fascinating.
I always feel twitchy after having Mark Berman on.
I'm sorry.
But that's okay.
Uh-oh.
Email from Genevieve. I have a wolf spider lurking in my cellar. He looks like a tarantula. Should I be concerned?
Concerned is a vague term.
It depends. Okay?
You should be concerned and excited.
I would be.
Yes, except for that wolf spider will not hurt you. And so you don't have to worry about the wolf spider. And it's down in your basement eating stuff that's more likely to hurt your house or you, like termites. Not saying they're there, but like...
How big is a wolf spider?
Well,
this tarantula reference here.
They do look a little bit... They're shaped and look a little bit like tarantulas. There aren't any
They have bones and stuff.
They don't have bones. None of these guys have bones. They're all arthropods, which means that they have legs that bend and an exoskeleton made out of chitin, C-H-I-T-I-N,
okay.
is a protein carbohydrate complex that makes their skin hard. And so a beetle that has a real hard skin has more chitin than like a caterpillar that's got a real soft skin.
Okay.
And so a wolf spider kind of looks like the classic you would see with a tarantula. I don't think their mouths go this. I mean, tarantulas' mouths go this way.
Meaning downward.
Mm-hmm, downward.
And wolves go pincer-like.
We're not sure.
Okay.
I think wolf spiders might go down this way too. But the wolf spider will completely not hurt you. It'll just eat other things that are living in your house. And it's really cool. And at night, if you take a flashlight, you'll see its eyes glow in the flashlight, which is cool,
oh,
too.
Oh, my.
Oh, stop. It's cool.
Okay, Genevieve, get a flashlight, go downtown, go to the basement, and look for the little glowing eyes.
Yeah, and don't be nervous about spiders that are living in your basement or the little fast centipedes that live in your basement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those predators don't want to mess with you. They want to eat the stuff that's getting in your basement, and especially usually means there's places of moisture in the basement where things are being attracted to the moisture and the fungi and stuff that grows on there. And so if you've got those predators, you probably want them.
That's where they go for lunch and dinner and breakfast. That's their MCL. Okay.
Okay.
We are going to take another break.
Okay, good.
With Mark Berman.
I have one more bug I don't want to miss.
Founder of Bugman Education. We have more bugs afoot. So if you want to check it out, what we're talking about, you can go to Facebook Live and watch. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the world of insects with entomologist and founder of Bugman Education, Mark Berman. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check us out on Facebook. We're on Facebook Live right now if you want to see what Mark has brought into the he's playing with the buttons now, so I don't know.
My button wasn't on.
Stop playing with the buttons, Mark Berman. If you want to talk about bugs with Mark Berman, give us a call. We have an email from KG who says, in the past year, I've had some little fly-like bugs in my bathroom. One or a few appear at a time, but perish or die within a few hours or days. I would personally kill them, KG. But anyways, KG goes on to say they can fly, but don't fly a lot, tend to just be still most of the time. They like to be near water, around the sink and toilet, yet they easily perish when they come in contact with water. They're very small, but their wings are huge in relation to their body. Any thought of what kind of bug this is?
There's one little fly that likes that that sort of habitat. Mm-hmm. It's called a sewer fly, mm-hmm. and it looks like a little black heart. And they've got fairly big wings for their body, and they don't move very much. But they usually do find them around bathrooms and places. And then there are a number of different, like, fruit fly kind of, vinegar fly kind of things that'll also just sort of be attracted to the water. And so, I mean, without pictures and stuff, it's hard to say. But they sounded almost, when she said, excuse me, when she said big wings, it almost sounded like sewer flies.
I think we had those before, but when we got our bathroom renovated, then we didn't have them back anymore. So I felt like they were just
old pipes
hatching something down in a drain somewhere.
Muck that's down in the old pipes and stuff. Yeah, and so, but they don't really do anything.
No,
except
they're just
fly around.
Yeah, kind of weird.
I can't believe you don't like having bugs in your house.
I'm not that persnickety. I mean, like I said, I don't kill the stink bugs. I take them outside.
I always say, uninvited guests, if it's a stink bug or Uncle Louie, it's a whole different level of respect.
You wanted to talk with us about something that DARPA, that's the military's research division, is proposing to engineer insects to transfer genes into crops. This sounds like, you know, a movie.
Sure. It's and
something will go wrong.
Of course it will. It's Michael's biggest fear.
There's no question that this cannot.
DARPA. You know, for a long time, people have sort of tried to look to bugs to solve a lot of engineering problems and a lot of science problems and a lot of sort of pest control problems.
Because they're the greatest engineers ever.
Well, they're amazing. But technology has just recently started getting us to the point where we can actually start appreciating it enough to take advantage of it. Genetic technology, but also like high-speed film, fMRI, and a lot of the techniques that just haven't been available until the last couple decades are now sort of hitting mainstream. And so DARPA is working on a lot more other interesting stuff too, aside from just trying to inoculate plants with engineered bugs. But, you know, we talked last time about the mosquito, the sterile release programs of male mosquitoes where they want to engineer them so that you can fix their genes so that they'll go out and mate with a female, but then they'll pass on a gene that's lethal to the developing offspring, like they can't produce the right hormones or something. And then they'll raise they did a big thing with cutworms, which are a kind of moth that feeds on like corn and crops, where they would produce males that would go out and they would produce males with a gene that made them require something like tetracycline or some kind of antibiotic to keep them alive. And so they would keep them alive and rear them out in the lab and then have these males go out and mate and pass that gene on, and there's none of that antibiotic in nature, and so none of the offspring could survive because they wouldn't have that required antibiotic or whatever that they put in the lab. So there's all kinds of really amazing, interesting things. And I think we mentioned last time, too, that you usually try to get to the reproductive part. If you can get to where they reproduce, that's where you can usually get to the life cycle.
But again, they're in a larger life cycle. You know, you wonder, what does it mean to birds and bats and things that ingest these
the
bugs?
The working assumption is that if you change a gene, that's kind of all you change. And so if you were going to like put a gene in something that needed an environmental factor to survive and it would die without that environmental factor, well, when you like if you ate a caterpillar with that gene, you wouldn't get that gene.
Mm-hmm.
You would digest it and break it down or poop it out or something. So the belief is that it's really hard to get something like that passed on through the environment.
Interspecies, yeah.
But it's new.
We don't know.
Who knows? And if they're working on things like transferring genes from an insect to a plant, then who knows what's going to happen? And the other interesting part about it is robotics and the things that they've been able to learn from insects, vision and how they move around with robotics. And I see you're ready to push the button, but just one more thing while I'm thinking about it. That's okay. You can't. Sorry, caller. But there was on 60 Minutes one time, and I've seen pictures of them recently, they've learned how to coordinate flying drones using some of the swarm behaviors of ants and, you know, how the way ants will move around with each other and with bees and with birds and the way that they can navigate in huge numbers without ever sort of making a mistake. And the objective is to sort of have drones be able to go out and explore like damaged buildings for survivors or to be able to in a group lift heavy objects and move them and do them all coordinated. And it's interesting because in the past, the way those things were done was to try to centrally control them so that you sort of had a controller who was controlling an algorithm for each drone to keep it in its place or whatever. But then once they start interacting with each other, the algorithms get so huge that the way an ant does it is each ant sort of has this set of instructions and they're interchangeable. One ant's as good as another. And you can get a whole bunch of them sort of doing all the same thing. And the instructions that they have, and they also can sense their world around them so that they can respond to things around them. And putting in instructions like that with the drones makes them so that they can sort of fly next to each other with all with the same very simple set of instructions, and they can follow and carry out very complex tasks that way. It's really fascinating what they're learning from animals.
The world of bugs.
Oh, man.
Oh, everything they're bringing from the world of bugs.
All right, you can push the button.
Judy in Piqua, you're on the air. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm loving this show. I'm a bug lover from way back. But I have an interesting spider in my basement right now, and I was just wondering what more you could tell me about it. It's got a very substantial web that's almost solid, and then it goes around two corners between a couple of pipes, so it's very big. It's like a foot long, and then the spider has a little hole.
No, the web was a foot long. The spider's not.
I know, but
okay.
It's just...
Sorry, Judy.
No, I'm thinking Lord of the Rings now. Go on, Judy.
I'd be calling somebody else if it was a foot long spider. No, the web is about a foot long, and the spider has a little hole in the corner that it goes into, and in the web, you know, it's like a little funnel. And I was just wondering what more you could tell me about that kind of spider. And I'm especially curious, since it doesn't have any predators in my basement, what kind of lifespan it might have.
Well, it sounds like a kind of grass spider, or sometimes they're called a funnel web spider. And a lot of times you'll see them on grass or in bushes, and they always have sort of like a little escape route, like a little tunnel in the back. And if you get anywhere near it, they'll just shoot right down in it. It's interesting that it's in your basement, though, because those are usually sort of out in the open, and you don't often see it in your basement. And I would guess, without prying or anything, that it's kind of wet down there and there's a lot of food. I might be wrong about that, but usually for a spider like that to take up in a basement, you would think it would need a lot of food, because they're usually kind of active and outside, and in bushes and stuff they get a lot of prey. And so I'm kind of surprised, but it's also very interesting. So it should be a little brown spider that sort of has stripy legs and disappears real fast down the tunnel. And if you take a little twig, and you can do this with the spiders out in your yard, and if you take a little twig and you kind of just, you have to act like a bug,
yeah,
right at the edge of their little funnel, they'll come peek back out to see what's going on, and so you can get a good look at them or a good photo. Okay. I know you always want to see the spiders that are
you like to know what's down there at least.
That's what it sounds like. I mean, that's the only kind of spider around here that would make sort of a big web like that, I would think.
I want to try to grab a couple, at least one more call. Judy, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. Danny in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Danny.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just had a quick question. Found a live tick, and I know they can carry certain diseases like Lyme disease. I was wondering if I should have that sent off somewhere to have it tested. I don't know, certain universities. I found one company that you have to pay to have it tested, but not really looking to pay $50 to have it take tested. So
no. Don't pay to have it tested. There's a chance that there's somebody at Ohio State who's taking care of it. I know that Glenn Needham, if he's still there, was the big tick guy there for a long time. And then George Keeney in the insectary. We'll know if anybody around there is interested in tick, but they would be interested probably more for data than anything. And I'm not sure if there's anyone doing that there now, but you might try to contact the entomology department at Ohio State. That said, if you're testing it for your own peace of mind, unless it was feeding on somebody, and especially for a long time, then you probably don't have to worry about it anyway, because whatever kind of tick it was, if it's going to spread Lyme disease, it's going to take 2 or 3 days at least for it to pass the pathogen on. And so you're probably not in any danger with respect to having it tested, especially if you don't think it bit anybody. Whether or not anybody's interested or not, it would be somebody at Ohio State probably, if anybody was.
Okay. Danny, thanks a lot. And then one more, Bill in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi,
yeah,
Bill.
Hi.
Pull over, Bill.
Yeah, we just recently moved into a condo, and it's a concrete slab,
uh-huh,
and one of the rooms seems to have these little gray bugs. They're about a quarter inch long, I have no idea what they are.
Well, can you tell us about more than the size?
I'm sorry?
Can you tell us more about the bug besides just the size? I mean, what do they look like?
Does it have legs?
Well, they're gray. They look kind of like a worm.
Do they have?
Can't really
see if they have legs or not.
You can't see if they have legs?
No.
Well, if part of building this whole thing was digging stuff up, then you might have dug up some beetle grubs. It almost sounds like they're a kind of beetle grub or maybe a fly larva.
Huh.
And usually one of the characteristics you want to look for is legs. And so if you can find legs and count them, then that usually narrows it down a little bit. I mean, if it's 6 legs, it's probably a kind of insect. And if it's 8 legs, it's probably a kind of arachnid. And if it doesn't have any legs, then it's probably like an immature fly or something. Mm. But it wasn't clear from the way you put it how long they had been around. And so it sounds like something that's an immature. And if you're finding them laying around, I think I would just probably scoop them up and put them out in the woods or something. But A little gray thing. It's hard to identify.
Yeah.
If you can navigate your way to our Facebook page or something and want to send some photos, we may be able to do better. Maybe not, though.
Okay, Bill, thanks a lot for that question. We have
I brought these beautiful caterpillars because we were talking about gardens. And people hate these. Those are tomato hornworms. And people hate them. And look at all the red poop on there. That's because they've been eating. If you eat too many tomatoes, you have red poop. And so they were eating artificial diet. Now, I have these to show people and talk about, you know, gardens and things like that. People think these are pests in your garden, but they're actually really beautiful. And they make a really beautiful moth if they don't eat all your tomato plants. I have them because they're bearded dragon food.
It's not like people think these are a pest, but they're actually, they are a pest, but they're also beautiful.
Beautiful, oh yeah.
And
tomato hornworms.
They make red poop, so if they eat, there you go.
They'll make tomatoes. Orange if they eat carrots, green if they eat lettuce.
We're
thanks
all
for
out
having
of time.
Us back. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. Mark Berman, entomologist, founder of Bugman Education. Always appreciate your time. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you're watching Facebook Live, you can check out these little dudes right now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.